from deep inside your radio.
From where else, then, would you like it? Ladies and gentlemen, from New Orleans, Louisiana, about which more in a few moments, another edition of the show coming your way. And Don Rumsfeld, of course, has stepped down from his position leading the Pentagon, but he's being channeled now by the President of the United States. The President this week had a news conference. There was a dispute because the Pentagon had held a confidential briefing, off-the-record briefing, that is. You couldn't name the briefers and you couldn't tape record it and there were no notes being taken and blah, 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 saying that the Iranian government, the highest levels of the Iranian government were responsible for certain devices, explosive devices being used against United States troops. And then a couple days later, the head of the United States military, General Peter Pace, said he didn't know if the head of the highest officials of the Iranian government were involved in that. So the dispute was bumped up to the presidential level. He was asked at the news conference about this apparent discrepancy. And channeling Don Rumsfeld, here's what the President of the United States said.
But here's my point. Either they knew or didn't know. What's worse, that the government knew or that the government didn't know?
That's cute. Ladies and gentlemen, what's worse, Pakistan being our friend or Pakistan being our friend? A senior U.S. military commander urges Pakistan to crack down on an entrenched network of senior Taliban and al-Qaeda leaders, training camps and recruiting grounds in Pakistan. Isn't that wild? They're our friend. This is a sanctuary from which fighters have tripled cross-border attacks since last September and are preparing the anticipated major spring offensive. This is Army Lieutenant General Carl Eikenberry. He's only the top U.S. commander in Afghanistan. He's going out the door, and he's urging Pakistan to crack down on his way out. He warns an even greater threat than the resurgent Taliban is the possibility that the government of President Karzai will suffer an irreversible loss of legitimacy among the population of Afghanistan. Al-Qaeda and Taliban leadership presence inside of Pakistan remains a very significant problem, Eikenberry testified before our House committee that's suddenly holding hearings on the subject. Warns of the growing threat of Talibanization inside Pakistan. Really? You mean they're going to do something worse than proliferate nuclear knowledge and materials to North Korea and Iran? Quote, a steady direct attack against the command and control in Pakistan and sanctuary areas is essential for us to achieve success, Eikenberry said. Well, that's easy. A critical question, Eikenberry said, is whether the Afghan government is winning. He said, in several critical areas, corruption, justice, law enforcement, and counter-narcotics, it is not. He says, Afghan government institutions are extraordinarily weak. Well, join the club, babe. The Taliban resurgence has been supported by a strengthened command and control structure that moved across the border into Pakistan right after U.S. forces toppled the Taliban. Today, Eikenberry says senior Taliban leaders are collaborating with al-Qaeda leaders in Pakistan. Pakistan's government, you may remember, last September struck the peace agreement that halted raids against the tribal areas where the al-Qaeda leadership is believed to be. Since then, the number of cross-border attacks has tripled. Eikenberry says there have been problems with the agreement. Problems like stupid agreement. What's worse, ladies and gentlemen, knowing or not knowing? Hello, welcome to the show.
They bought This is LeShow. Every once in a while, we take time out to talk about my favorite city and what is or what is not going on in it with people who are in a position to know. And one of those people is with me today. He's a friend, but he's knowledgeable and a student of, among other things, the culinary arts, and also a native New Orleanian and a columnist for the New Orleans Times-Picayune, whose columns I commend to you, Lolas Eric Eli. Lolas, welcome to the show.
It's a pleasure.
It's been a long time. I've been trying to get you here for a while.
I know, but I listened to the podcast.
Oh, good.
And you have done well by us, man, to keep this before the public eye.
Thanks. Well, you wrote a stunning piece, op-ed piece, in last Sunday's Washington Post, basically setting the table for whoever reads it to look at carnival season and what the country does not understand about New Orleans. Let's start, as we're in the climax of carnival here, with what is it that the country doesn't understand about Mardi Gras and carnival in New Orleans?
Well, for people who live in New Orleans, imagine, they got people of all ages here. So everybody's not going to be out taking their clothes off on Bourbon Street. You know, my grandmother doesn't do that.
Really? That's not what I hear.
But, you know, what happens is that there's this whole sort of fascination with what takes place on Bourbon Street or in the French Quarter. But growing up, man, carnival was like a picnic. You go and you find your place on neutral ground or whatever part of the town you want to be in. You pack a lunch. And it's you, your cousins, your mother, your father, your grandparents, your best friends, your neighbors. And it's a fun time that the parade occasions. But the parade is not the be-all and end-all. A lot of it is about fellowship.
Mm. I noticed that, because I go to a spot at the neutral ground near the start of the parade route, that the same people have their spot picked out every year.
Yeah. It's a tradition in all sorts of ways. And you know, I can remember we used to be at that Napoleon in St. Charles every carnival day. And it ends up being sort of base camp. So, you know, you're a kid, you're about 12 or 13. Not quite old enough to go away totally on your own, but you can go away for about a half hour and come back and check in, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's the same kind of
thing. The long leash.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. There is this sense that New Orleans has had its image painted by the auteur of the Girls Gone Wild videos and the makers of Budweiser commercials, and that is what the country thinks of as a sinful sort of sinkhole. And the vast majority of the people who engage in that behavior, if I'm not mistaken, are the tourists who come here to seek that out, yeah?
They come here expecting to watch us do that, and we go to the French Quarter to watch them. You know, I mean, I don't know of any of my friends who do that kind of stuff.
Mm.
Our idea of fun here is some good food, some good music, and some good alcohol. But, you know, it's not about trying to fall out, because the people who you see when you're throwing up on the corner are the same people you're going to see at work the next day or at school or at church. So that's not what New Orleans is about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a good time for us is not measured by how much alcohol you consume. It's about how much dancing you do, how many friends you see, how many jokes you hear, you know.
There is a phrase that I started hearing here that I'd never heard anywhere else that describes some of what goes on by the out-of-towners. The phrase is amateur drinkers.
Yeah. These are folks who are drinking and get drunk, and they don't understand how to pace themselves. They don't realize it's going to be a long night. You don't want to climax at the beginning, you know. It's kids of all ages, basically.
Mm-hmm. There was a very controversial piece written in GQ magazine recently. A writer came down and said, the food here basically is mediocre, if not worse, and there's no such thing as a Creole.
And he did
this in the name of journalism.
These were conclusions arrived at without benefit of research or education. One of the funniest things about it is that he interviewed Leah Chase at length. And Leah Chase is the most famous Creole chef of the country, and she talks about it. I mean, we can debate what Creole means and who's Creole and who's not Creole, but that's a big part of Leah Chase's identity and the identity of her food. And now he claims that he's doing just harsh, honest criticism of some things and some people that need to be looked at closely. I would agree we need to be looked at closely, But you got to look at us closely. Don't make conclusions that you would make. If I had looked at them closely, this is what I would have concluded. I mean, that's what you're dealing with here. Mm. And it's just erroneous in so many ways. You know, he did a radio podcast interview based on the article, and he can't pronounce the names of the restaurants that he's talking about. The other thing is that he describes gumbo. And he says, all this gumbo I had was all thick and so forth, and it's supposed to be a soup, but it's not really a soup. Then he says, well, burgoo, now that's a real good dish. It's somewhere between a soup and a stew, and they know what they're doing. Well, gumbo, though it's always in the soup section of the menu, is more like between a soup and a stew. And there are a whole lot of things that he said about it. It's like, well, you know, if you'd actually asked someone, then you could actually have received some education on these points. But, you know, as I said, he used errors in his piece with a frequency that most writers reserve for punctuation marks.
Was the basic attitude among the food community that you know down here anger or resignation or amusement at that piece?
All three, but mostly anger. Because there's several things about it. He starts off saying, I never liked the food in New Orleans. And then I'm saying, well, if you know that, then why are you coming down here?
Mm-hmm.
There was also this sense that folks here are really struggling. Restaurants in particular having difficulty getting help. Service is good, but often less than crisp because of a lack of help. And if you're going to criticize under those circumstances, you really do need to have your ducks in a row. And so to come down and write something that is ill-informed and so aggressively ignorant, it's a real kick in the teeth.
I thought that he was not just aggressively ignorant, but proudly ignorant.
Exactly.
I'm gonna throw some questions at you that people ask me as I go around the country, and it's known that I'm part of the time from here. Why did New Orleans reelect Ray Nagin?
There's a strange coalition of right-wing white people and a lot of black folks, certainly not all. On the right wing, white folks are still mad at Moon Landrieu, the father of Nagin's opponent, who desegregated City Hall.
He was the last white mayor.
Exactly. Remains my father's favorite mayor. Hmm. Because although there's some things that he didn't understand, like historic preservation, he understood that this was and has always been a city, a multiracial city. And if we're going to make any kind of progress, it has to be on that basis. So there were some people there who did not want Mitch Landrieu to win because of his perceived liberal leanings, which is sort of a joke because his sister is the U.S. Senator from here, Mary Landrieu, and she is certainly not liberal. On the other side, there are black folks who said, we don't want to lose this seat. So even putting aside whether Nagin is good or bad, there's a sense that this is something that black people have fought for 200 years and we deserve to keep it, et cetera, et cetera. And then there were people, black people, who felt that if Nagin was reelected with overwhelming black support, then he'd then be more sensitive to issues of particular interest to black people. Well, you know, all that's proven to be false. And there's another aspect of it, because I can't just put it on Nagin's supporters. I mean, Nagin ran a brilliant campaign. Nagin, in essence, played the race card in very subtle ways. He talked about reelecting our mayor. Well, that can be we in a whole lot of different contexts for a whole lot of different people. But Mitch Landrieu was in a strange position because Nagin, to some extent rightly, was seen as under siege by forces beyond his control. And the fact that the federal government and the state government had not come to his assistance in the way that he thought was appropriate meant that people in New Orleans sided with him in that regard. When he went on his tirade about the lack of federal assistance in the first couple of days after the storm, everybody from New Orleans said, yes, mm-hmm. That is what we're complaining about. Well, Mitch Landrieu had to figure out how to criticize the mayor without appearing to blame him for things that were beyond his control or without appearing to be just as bad as all these other folks who were criticizing the mayor. And I think ultimately, Landrieu tried to run a campaign saying, I'll be better, not really talking about exactly what he would do to be a better mayor. The other problem is that there are a whole lot of people who fear that the city in an attempt to come back as a smaller, more compact, more efficient city, is going to write off a bunch of the areas that flooded. And no one was willing to come out and say, yes, I am, in fact, going to recommend that we bulldoze the following areas. Now, my attitude in part is that they don't have a vision for how to communicate to people. Well, it's possible that we could eliminate some small areas and keep others, or come up with a way that will be to the benefit of all of us, including the residents whose neighborhoods may in part have to be bulldozed.
When people say there may be parts of the city that may have to not be rebuilt, a lot of folks hear that as, and the people who live there will not be invited back. And nobody's been able to clearly say we're talking about real estate, not people. The most uncovered by the national media story to me, to my eyes, in recent weeks in New Orleans has been Ed Blakely. And I can't go to a meal without people sitting around talking about, do you know this guy? What do you think about him? Mm-hmm. Have you met him? What's your take on him? One of the few acts that anybody knows that Mayor Nagin has performed since being reelected was to name a recovery czar. Ed Blakely has this very impressive resume, having presided over, was it Oakland or San Francisco after the earthquake?
Several places.
Yeah.
Oakland fires and I think San Francisco earthquake.
Yeah. Has gone around the world. I think he did some time in Australia.
Not the proper term.
No, I agree.
Spent some time in Australia. There you are saying we have another felon on the payroll.
But has this very impressive resume for having presided over the recovery from disasters of many metropolitan areas. And he's come in here and he's talked fairly explicitly about what he would do in terms of maybe retiring some parts of the city geographically from settlement, but using land swaps to make it possible for the people who live there to have a new place to live. That's all by way of background. Have you met him? What's your take on him?
I actually was at a dinner party with him a few nights ago and sat next to him and was quite impressed. One of my main concerns about our mayor is a certain lack of vision, a certain real understanding of where the city would be if he were totally in charge. And often what you have is the mayor will say, well, the market will determine where people will rebuild. And obviously, if there are stores and so forth in your neighborhood, that encourages you to rebuild your house. But if the market's going to be in control, why do we need a mayor?
Mm-hmm.
Well, Ed Blakely, when you ask him these questions, it's funny because you get the impression, rightly, that he's done this a million times before. And he has answers that are not so much rehearsed as conditioned or practiced, I should say, because the kinds of issues we're dealing with are the kinds of issues that have been done around the world. And he says that during the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, he was in China. And people ask him why he was in China when the soul of America was underwater. And that was part of his impetus for coming back, because he had been invited to speak here several times before the mayor actually hired him to be the recovery czar. You know, until someone actually begins to implement policy, or until you see how they come down on hard questions in which you have a personal stake, it's difficult to evaluate them. But we get from him far more so than from the mayor, far more so than from anybody on the city council, in the state legislature, or in the governor's mansion, is a real sense of direction, a real sense of vision, and a real sense of experience.
One might ask why it took the mayor 17 months to appoint a recovery czar.
Well, the mayor is a more thoughtful man than might be obvious from the decisions he makes. One of the knocks against them is that it takes him a long time to make a decision.
Mm.
And the decisions he makes often end up taking place with a surprising lack of consultation with the community.
Mm.
And I'll give you one quick and obvious one. They got these new garbage cans in the French Quarter, which are wonderful. They're big and they can be picked up by automated trash trucks and so forth. The problem is the French Quarter is an old part of the city. So this kind of suburban model can't work in that area. Well, that's the kind of thing that somebody thoughtful, somebody from New Orleans, should have understood or should have been able to get information on. Not our mayor.
He doesn't come to the French Quarter, I guess. You know, when I was thinking about him and his office, I thought back to the performance of Rudy Giuliani in New York in the aftermath of 9/11. And it seemed that Giuliani took as his template an old Woody Allen line, you know, that 90% of the job is showing up. He was here, he was there, he was making himself a visible leader. And to me, part of the problem with Reinagen, and it's been exemplified in the number of people who sort of as an ironic greeting to me say, now, have you seen Clarence? As he's been invisible. He's, especially since the re-election, donned a cloak of invisibility. When one would expect, you know, okay, you don't have money, you don't have resources, you have a recalcitrant city council. The least you can do is there are these small businessmen who are, you know, moving heaven and earth trying to survive. Be around. Say, hey, you're leading the recovery. I'm proud of you. The restaurants are leading the recovery. Be out of the restaurant every night saying, this is the heart and soul of the culinary culture of America, and I'm proud of, you know.
Yeah. Well, one thing, I'm very sensitive to comparison with Giuliani only because the World Trade Center had a whole lot of symbolic importance. We're talking about a relatively small amount of real estate and a small percentage of overall New York. And so in that sense, he had a far, far bigger problem than Giuliani. Additionally, the shorthand analysis of what happened on 9/11 is a bunch of foreigners came in and attacked us. So you can go through all the shenanigans about whether or not Clinton or Bush didn't do what they were supposed to do. But we can all focus and rally around a foreign enemy. Well, our enemy here was domestic in a lot of ways. The failure of the Army Corps of Engineers, the failure of the president to send help soon, et cetera, et cetera. Also, finally, Reinagen stayed here during the storm.
Mm-hmm.
And he could have left. He didn't. In terms of what's happened subsequently, Reinagen is strange because I find Reinagen to be personally likable.
Mm-hmm.
But he seems not to enjoy going out and shaking people's hands and so forth. Also, he has absolutely no understanding of the importance of culture. And that means a couple of things. One is a sort of culture of human interaction and what it means beyond simply the idea of greeting your friends, but the kind of larger thing you allude to of being seen and what that means. Additionally, in talking about culture being so important to New Orleans, talking about the food, the music, the architecture, and how championing those things will help champion the cause of the city, he doesn't understand that at all. He tends to think in a larger corporate model about how we're going to get some big company to come down here, not how we're going to help the small ones survive. Additionally, he is an uninspiring speaker. Even when he's saying things that you agree with, he does not know how to phrase things in such a way as to stir men's souls.
Mm.
So even if you had him present at these events, you know, he speaks in a sort of off-the-cuff, everyday folksy style, which is fine if you're talking about reopening the swimming pool for the kids or, you know, having him come by for the bake sale and buy a couple of cookies. That's wonderful. But at this point, we need someone who can speak to us and rally us and speak to the nation. The other thing is that, you know, somebody who does a lot of public speaking, you got a decision to make between how you're gonna handle being off the cuff and doing prepared remarks. Well, invariably, he'll say some things off the cuff that are so incredibly stupid that you're like, man, why did you walk out your house without a script? Who told you to do this? Classic example, he gets on 60 Minutes and he says, well, y'all saying that New Orleans is coming back slowly, but look at the World Trade Center, and that's just a hole in the ground, and it's been all these years after 9/11. Now, mind you, it's possible they've said, look, they're still trying to figure out how to proceed with this terrible tragedy in New York, and thus we are not so far behind. But to come out and slap the people in New York in the face like that, or slap the nation in the face like that, these are not the words of a thinking man.
Lillis, Eli. We'll have more thoughts on New Orleans in a moment, but now, news from outside the bubble. Well, how's the security crackdown going in Iraq? According to the British newspaper The Telegraph, at least 56 people were killed and 120 wounded in 3 car bomb attacks in Baghdad today. Militants are defying a security crackdown. This just 2 days after the country's prime minister, al-Maliki, had praised the new crackdown as a brilliant success. Dick Cheney must be writing his speeches, speaking of speeches. From the British newspaper The Times of London, owned by Rupert Murdoch, Middle Eastern countries are secretly arming and supporting suspected al-Qaeda recruits in the failed state of Somalia in a direct challenge to Western interests in East Africa, according to the UN. UN investigators detailed military aid given to the Islamists by Saudi Arabia and Egypt, Arab states friendly to the West. That's the Axis of Good. And from the Sunday Telegraph of London, there's a new ethical version of foie gras. Hello, Chicago. Allowing fans of the food to savor it with a clear conscience. The product sidesteps accusations of cruelty because it's not made by force-feeding geese. It allows geese to stock up on extra food naturally in preparation for their normal winter migration to Africa. Once they fatten themselves for their expected long flight south, they're slaughtered. What a surprise to them. Your flight has been delayed. Ethical foie gras, ladies and gentlemen. News from outside the bubble, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Now back to our conversation with New Orleans Times-Picayune columnist Lolis Eric Eli.
I'm sure you get this. This is another of that series of questions that one gets asked around the country. Why did New Orleans reelect Bill Jefferson?
Well,
For those who don't know the cause of Lolis's laughter, Bill Jefferson is the Democratic congressman who the feds claim to have found $90,000 in cash in his freezer.
Yeah, but first of all,
has not been charged with anything.
The weather gets very hot, both in D.C. and in New Orleans, in Louisiana. So having some cold cash to stuff in your pockets while you're walking around is one way of beating the heat. The feds have never acknowledged that. On a more serious side, Jefferson's opponent was a woman who supported the state takeover of the Orleans Parish Schools several years ago. Orleans Parish Schools were terrible in all sorts of ways, and the board was incompetent in all sorts of ways, but we elected them. And for her to do that rubbed a whole lot of people the wrong way. Additionally, racial politics becomes very important, and among her biggest supporters were some of the richest, most conservative white people who live outside the city of New Orleans, within the state of Louisiana in the greater New Orleans area, but outside the city of New Orleans. So there's this sense of her siding with people who are not on the side of black New Orleanians or liberal democratic New Orleanians. Mm. Additionally, in Spike Lee's film about Hurricane Katrina, she criticized the people in Jefferson Parish, a neighboring parish, for not allowing New Orleanians to flee into their parish trying to get out of the storm. Among the people that she was criticizing were, for the most part, white politicians in areas to which white flight has taken place in the last 20, 30 years. The district that Bill Jefferson represents includes both Orleans and Jefferson Parish, or parts of each. And in essence, she insulted a whole lot of people, a whole lot of conservative white people in Jefferson Parish, and they made a concerted effort not to elect her. Finally, Bill Jefferson's a good politician. He's an incredibly smart man. Rumors about his illegal dealings have been going around for at least a couple of decades. And there's also the sense that people don't want to be told who to vote for or what to do, particularly in an era when we feel that the nation has not come to our assistance to the extent that would be appropriate given the nature and dimensions of this disaster.
Yeah, on your last point, there was a statistic that appeared in the New York Times that compared the per capita property impact of Hurricane Andrew in Florida, Hurricane Katrina along the Mississippi coast, and whatever it was that happened in New Orleans. And it was, I think, $100-something in Florida, $400-something in Mississippi, and $6,700 per person in New Orleans.
Those are the kind of statistics that the president does not want to discuss. I mean, one thing I need to make very clear, George Bush was not responsible for what happened in Hurricane Katrina. He may have been responsible for the slowness of the federal response, but the fact that the Army Corps of Engineers, by its own admission, built levees that were insufficient or were not even to the standards that they were supposed to be, that is the cause of what happened in New Orleans. not even the storm itself, because the storm was not that strong, not as strong as it was predicted. So given that, it seemed to me like the perfect opportunity for President Bush to come here and say, look, I didn't do this. Bill Clinton didn't do this. My father didn't do this. Ronald Reagan didn't do this. But the fact that the levee system has not been strong enough for you over all of these decades is an opportunity for us to address these things and for the federal government to take responsibility. In part because the president did such a bad job in the immediate aftermath of the storm, and in part because of party politics, he couldn't let it seem as if conservative Republicans had messed up, it became crucial for him to blame other people or to pretend that the money he has sent to Louisiana is some huge sum of money, when in fact, given our need, given the admitted culpability of the United States Army Corps of Engineers, we deserve to be made whole. Yet what he will do is he'll take some figures out of the air. Well, we spent $110 billion. Well, that's for four states, none of which have been hit as hard as Louisiana with Hurricane Katrina and the subsequent Hurricane Rita disaster. And the thing I'm trying to tell people in the rest of the country is, man, don't support assistance for Louisiana simply because we're nice people and everybody deserves a break. You need to support it because the agencies that failed us are supposed to be protecting you. If something happens to you in Oklahoma and Michigan and California and Tennessee, the Federal Emergency Management Agency is going to be the people who are supposed to be there for you. If they weren't there for us, what makes you think they're going to be there for you? The Army Corps of Engineers released a list of 27 states in which it has projects that are in need of repair, that are in danger of failing, dams and bridges and levees and so forth. Well, what makes you think that they failed in Louisiana, but they're not going to fail where you live? So my point is, this is a national issue that folks have to deal with, not out of charity, but out of self-interest. And additionally, if the federal government will not appropriately compensate Louisianans for our losses that resulted from their negligence, their incompetence, their admitted inability to do what they themselves said they were going to do, we can assume that the same kind of pattern will happen when disaster strikes elsewhere.
You've been on the front lines of what recovery really is like here, because you've been cleaning up and fixing up your mom's house. Talk a little bit about what that's been like.
Well, first of all, man, you know what it's like in California now trying to do renovations.
Yes, I do.
So you're trying to get somebody to show up. You're trying to get somebody competent. You're trying to get somebody not to show up the first day, but to show up the rest of the days. Well, imagine if 60% of the people in your city are all trying to get that kind of work done. That's the first hurdle, the competition for finding someone who's going to show up. Also, prices have gone through the roof. They were going higher even before this because of the alleged reconstruction in Iraq. So I remember 2 years ago, my carpenter telling me, well, you know, plywood are just shooting through the roof because they sent it all to Iraq. Well, imagine if you got everybody in southern Louisiana needing to buy sheetrock. Well, first of all, you're lucky to get it. And then you go there and you say, well, it's $2 more than it used to be. I'm glad to pay the price, glad to have it. That's a big part of the problem. Additionally, where are you going to get the money? Well, there are a whole lot of people who, when they bought their homes, were told, well, you're not in a floodplain, so you don't need flood insurance. Well, whose fault is it that you didn't take it? And I will make no conclusion there, but just to point out the difficulty in assessing blame. Let's assume that you had paid for your house already, or that you inherited your house. You were therefore not required to keep insurance. So maybe you figured instead of spending $2,000, $3,000, $4,000 a year on insurance, you'd put that aside to do repairs. On the face of this kind of disaster, the money you were able to put aside is negligible. Additionally, in the best case scenario, when you have homeowners insurance, which will take care of wind damage, and flood insurance, which will take care of water damage, you end up in a strange position. The flood insurance program is a federal program, in part in recognition of the fact that flood claims can be so devastating in a real disaster. So the private market, your private insurance guy may sell it to you, but it's a federal program. It tends to be less generous than the homeowner's policy that you pay for. So what the insurance companies have been trying to do is tell everybody that their damage is not wind damage, it's water damage.
To put it on the federal program.
Exactly. Well, you got to have this argument with your insurance company, and you're having this argument with somebody who's living in some comfortable office in Baltimore or Delaware or somewhere, and he ain't in no hurry to solve this thing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what are you going to do if it's going to be another month, another 6 months, another year before you get the money you're supposed to get? Where are you going to live? How are you going to live? How are you going to rebuild? How do you deal with the kind of depression that comes from that uncertainty? Additionally, man, a thing that is hard to explain to people who ain't dealing with this is the toll that this takes on people physically. People have been having high blood pressure, diabetes, or gout or whatever for all these years, and they deal with it. All of a sudden now it's worse than ever. Folks are dropping dead, you know, 80, 90-year-old people who had been from all with signs strong, dropping dead. Now, we have no doubt that it's from homesickness, from the uncertainty, from the frustration of trying to deal with this.
I'm going through physical therapy right now for my shoulder, and I was talking to my physical therapist this morning here, and she said, you know, you wouldn't believe the number of people who are coming in just for that, because they're doing all this work themselves, and they're coming in with shoulders and backs and stuff. And so even on that relatively trivial level, the physical toll is pretty impressive. Yeah.
But that's trivial if nobody else you know is going through that, which means that, you know, your wife, your friends, your mother, your father, your kids can be helpful to you and can be supportive. Well, it's kind of like, man, you're in the whole city's a hospital ward.
Mm.
So on one hand, people we're warm and engaging here, and yes, I listen to your problem if you listen to mine. On the other hand, it's like that scene in Candide where it's like, look, man, you see all them people over there? They got the same thing you got. So, you know, you got a problem getting the back of the line. And there's an aspect of American culture that is both very, very helpful and very, very detrimental to us now, the sort of sense of the self-reliant individual. And like you talk about these people who are doing it by themselves, who are fixing their own houses because they can't afford to hire contractors, mm-hmm. because they can do it, so they will do it. There's this notion that is what you should do. Everybody can't do that. There are people who lack the money. There are people who are too old to do that. There are people who lack even the resources to do the work themselves. And so this notion that New Orleans should be rebuilt now because that's what Americans would do, this sort of can-do attitude. Well, you know, that's beautiful in theory. But try to come here when, you know, a 90-year-old woman, Willie Mae Seton, who has a restaurant that flooded. She had this vision that her 75-year-old son was going to rebuild it because he's a handyman. So she had no concept of what it was going to take to put this place back together. We're dealing with that on a whole lot of levels, times, you know, a couple of 100,000 people.
We'll continue our conversation with Lola's Eric Eli in a moment. But a story we've been following on this broadcast. Secretary of State Rice misled the Congress when she said last week she had not seen that 2003 Iranian proposal for talks with the United States. This according to Flint Leverett, who worked on the National Security Council when it was headed by Rice. Leverett said this was a serious proposal, a serious effort by Iran to lay out a comprehensive agenda for U.S.-Iranian agreement. The Bush administration, up to and including Rice, is misleading Congress and the American public about the Iran proposal. At the State Department, the spokesman said what she has said is that she has no recollection of having seen it. She has said that repeatedly, so she has a recollection of having said that she has no recollection. And the nub of this may be the State Department spokesperson, Leverett, saying that then-Secretary of State Colin Powell, in a discussion about the Iranian proposal, told him he, quote, couldn't sell it at the White House. Meanwhile, the Swiss ambassador to Iran informed U.S. officials in 2003 that an Iranian proposal for comprehensive talks had been reviewed and approved by Iran's supreme leader. The leader knew about it, or he didn't know about it. No, he did know about it. Ayatollah Khamenei. I got the clear impression there's a strong will of the regime to tackle the problem with the U.S. now and to try it with this initiative, said the Swiss ambassador to Iran in a cover letter that was faxed to the State Department on May 4th, 2003, according to the Washington Post. The cover letter has not been previously disclosed. It was provided by a source who felt its contents were mischaracterized by State Department officials. But as I said, the nub may be this. The State Department spokesman says, "The last 30 years are filled with examples of individuals claiming to represent Iranian views. We've offered Iran a chance to sit across the table from us and discuss their nuclear issue and anything else they would like, as long as they simply verifiably suspend their uranium enrichment activities," unquote. In other words, we'll talk to them as long as they do what our goal from the talks is before we start the talks. Either they know that or they don't know that. Now back to our discussion of New Orleans and issues relating to New Orleans with New Orleans Times-Picayune columnist Lolis Eric Eli.
The unanimity of the National Democrats was shattered when a Democratic congressman from, or as President Bush would like to say, a Democrat congressman from down here, Charlie Melançon, went public and said the Democratic leadership has basically given lip service to New Orleans, has thrown us a bone, but really hasn't done the job. And a day later, he comes out and says, well, apparently they've listened to me, and legislation is now going to be speeding through, and they've set up committees. Was this what it appears, or was this a show?
It's hard to say, because I don't remember Louisiana as having been a major part of the Democratic agenda for taking over Congress.
Mm-hmm.
It's not as if it was a big deal for Nancy Pelosi. You know, she's been here. She said the right thing, but she's not said that there's a national disgrace and therefore we're going to deal with it. Part of what has happened is that the Democrats have not offered a counter-narrative to explain what's going on down here. The president is basically saying, look, the federal government is doing all this can. We're giving you a whole lot of money, and y'all are messing it up. It's time for y'all to do something with it. In Louisiana, we say, well, first of all, these big numbers you're talking about are to be split among four states. Second of all, we're not getting the lion's share of that money anyway. And third, the amount of money and assistance we've gotten has been insufficient. I guess finally, in disasters, the state is supposed to repay the federal government 10 or 20% of the money spent for disaster recovery, or to provide a 10 or 20% match. Well, in Louisiana, we're saying, wait a minute, man. The city that was responsible for like 40% of the state revenue and a whole lot of the outlying areas have been devastated. We don't have the money. More to the point, though, this match has been forgiven in almost every disaster for the past 30 years.
It's forgiven in New York after 9/11. It's forgiven in Florida after Andrew, I believe.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So if we are talking about a disaster of greater scale than all of these other disasters, then why are we being asked to repay the money? Now, mind you, what the legislation said that quote-unquote gave us, or the Gulf region, is $110 billion, it said that these loans are to be repaid back, notwithstanding the relevant sections of, I think, the Stafford Act. Yeah. And so they're going out of their way to penalize us. You know, we talk about New Orleans because New Orleans is the epicenter of it and became sort of the poster child. But in many ways, the problems in New Orleans fit into a neat assumption about lazy, poor black people waiting for government handouts. New Orleans Saints football fans went to Chicago for the NFC Championship game. And, you know, you expect a certain amount of razzing when you're playing for a big game. But the kinds of things that people were saying to our fans went far beyond that. One guy tells a story of folks next to him saying, oh, you're in Katrina? How'd you do? Well, I had 11 feet of water in my house. They said, I wish you had drowned. I mean, this kind of... But that, and all those cities saying, well, how'd you get up here? Did FEMA buy your ticket? Is FEMA bringing you back?
Mm.
People are angry at us, I think, because we've exemplified the weaknesses of the way in which this country handles its own people. And there's this sense of telling family secrets, and therefore the problem is not that the secret needs to be addressed, that the issues need to be addressed. The problem is that we told.
Told to the world.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, man, I was just in India. People in India know about Hurricane Katrina. And we used to be known for Louis Armstrong. Now we're known for Hurricane Katrina. friend of mine in New Orleans who works with a group called Africare talks about all of the African leaders who were calling her in the days after the storm, offering sympathy and saying, this looks familiar, too familiar. And the Democrats, I think, could say, first of all, the problems are not really the fault of anyone currently sitting in office. So we don't have to blame the president, the vice president, the previous Congresses. But we do need to address the problem. They're failing to do that.
But isn't that exactly the problem? The stuff that gets addressed in modern politics is the stuff that allows you to blame somebody else who's currently in office. Mm-hmm. And the stuff that doesn't get addressed is the stuff that doesn't provide political juice, that doesn't energize your base, that doesn't get people to give you money, that doesn't, you know, allow you to say that person sitting right there is the reason this happened. And the Corps of Engineers is this faceless agency which has been fed by Democrats and Republicans alike for generations and generations, and nobody gets any political juice out of attacking them or out of calling them to account.
If you want to make it a partisan battle, make your linchpin the failures of President Bush and his administration in the days immediately after Katrina. As a classic example, man, you got this segment on the show about news of inspectors general.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the inspectors general, or their ilk, I should say, have been looking at all these people who fraudulently got the $2,000 that President Bush showered on Louisianans in the week or two after the storm. You know, I got no sympathy for people who were doing that, getting three and four of those checks, and other folks were having difficulty getting one. But the reason they were showering those checks is because they had no plan for what to do in this kind of disaster. They had not come up with a way to deal with this thing. And so they had to just throw money at the situation, do exactly what they always say is the wrong solution, to throw money at something. And when you get to the point where you're trying to give $2,000 to each and every deserving person out of Louisiana displaced because of the storm, there are a whole lot of people going to get checks who shouldn't get them. Well, whose fault is it that this fraud has taken place when you haven't done even the kind of preparation and safeguards that are necessary?
Mm.
And additionally, is anybody investigating the layers of contractors who the government would pay $6,000 and $7,000 to patch a roof when a new roof would have cost about that amount of money? But in fact, by the time the contractor gets his $6,000 and the subcontractor gets four and somebody else gets two, and the poor schlep putting on the roof gets $500. There's a company out of Alabama who, in the days after the no-bid contracts went out, bid and said he could do these jobs for less than a third the price. He was approved for up to $100 million of work. He got far less work than that, and they kept giving the no-bid contracts to the big contractors. Well, why are we worrying about somebody who stole $2,000 here, $4,000 there, when the people getting away with millions and millions and millions? This was a government-enabled disaster, and we've fallen victim to government-encouraged fraud.
Mm. Lawless, you're a native New Orleanian. Your family has deep roots here. As you look at the situation, what's your feeling about the future of the place? I started in about November hearing friends asking kind of existential questions about the future here, which surprised me.
Hmm. We have two contradictory messages. One is that if you come here today, we can have a great time. The old parts of the city that you as a tourist would have wanted to see, the place where the nightclubs, the restaurants, the museums, the fancy houses, they're back. The older parts of the city were not so badly hit. Much of our problem stemmed from the fact that the newer areas of the city, where a lot of our population was, those areas are not coming back rapidly because the people lack the money. The state has done a bad job administering that money. We also have major infrastructure problems. The most obvious one is that we pump as much water through the city every day. I'm sorry, we pump twice as much as we use, meaning there are all sorts of leaks in the water lines. Well, imagine that problem in every other aspect of it, in terms of law enforcement, in terms of utilities, in terms of just the various kinds of things that we need. people are very frustrated now. There are a couple of things that will determine whether or not you're going to come back. One is, do you have a place to stay? Do you have a job? Does your spouse have a job? Do the kids have a place to go to school? If you lose one or two legs off of that chair, then the impetus for staying here, coming back, is decreased. We have had a serious crime problem. It seems to have gone from ridiculous levels to, gone from being absolutely ridiculous to just ridiculous in terms of the number of murders taking place and the sense of insecurity, which again leads people not to be in a hurry to come back. It's clear now that we'll be lucky to get half of our population back in the next year or two. New Orleans is certainly going to be a smaller city based on population. The whole lot of people, though, people like you who love New Orleans and realize that life is lived here in a way it is lived nowhere else in the world. The richness of life here that's attractive to people. And I'm confident that we will remain a viable city, will continue to grow, and in some ways may recover from this in ways that will make us stronger than we had been previously, in terms of being able to think through a future as opposed to the kind of haphazard things that happen when you evolve over time. So I elect to be optimistic, but I know full well how easy and appropriate it is to paint a pessimistic picture. Hmm.
And does that optimism include the culture of New Orleans?
Yeah. I interviewed Ellis Marsalis not long after the storm, and everyone was talking about how the culture was going to die. He's like, man, don't be ridiculous. And I rethought that. There's some significant people who have not come back. You know, the artist John Scott is not back, and there are a lot of musicians.
Henry Butler's not back.
Right. The Neville brothers
are
not back. But in terms of can you go to 10 or 12 clubs a night in New Orleans and hear great music, yes. In terms of this sense that the music is part of what keeps us here, the food is part of what keeps us here, and therefore we're supporting these institutions and these individuals, that's definitely going on. The New Orleans Musicians Clinic, the Tipitina's Foundation, the Grammy Awards, Jazz at Lincoln Center have all done a whole lot to help out our musicians in this context. Viking Range Corporation, the Southern Foodways Alliance, have attempted to help us bring restaurant workers back, help us solidify the restaurant industry. And speaking to Ed Blakely, he talked about an understanding of the need for architectural preservation and the idea that these old houses that are blighted and abandoned now, some because of Katrina, some not, he's not looking at a wholesale demolition of those properties. And finally, the people who've come back, whether they were born in New Orleans or not, are people who are here because they love the culture. You know, I got a whole different view about folks who live here who are not from here. And I think they may be, they're at least as important to the culture as the native born. Because, you know, man, you're not going to come here to try to get rich. You're not going to come here because this is the hot new place. You're going to come here because what this city has to offer is something you want to support. So, man, you probably go to more nightclubs than I do, you know?
That's for sure.
So.
I never see you out there.
So I'm like, you know, man.
It's the fervency of the convert. Well, I do love the city, and I love it partly because at this point in its history, everybody I know is having serious, impassioned discussions about the future of the city. Whether it seems to the outsider that the official level is recalcitrant or uncaring, the citizens definitely aren't. And the amount of citizen activism and citizen energy and attentiveness that I've seen here in the last year, the number of organizations that have sprung up and the focused level of the meetings that I've gone to with none of the usual people wandering off on tangents and, no, I'm at the microphone just because you need to hear me. It's pretty remarkable, and it speaks to me a little bit well of the future of the place.
Well, I had an interesting conversation not long after the storm with a very conservative friend of mine who's talking about, well, you know, we need to get government out of the way. You and I can do this. And I'm saying, man, you and I can't build levees. But I'm seeing his point a lot better now. in the way in which citizens are doing things without worrying about or while waiting for the government. There's some things that we have to wait for the government on. There's some things that are certainly government's responsibility. But ultimately, we got to take responsibility for ourselves, and we're doing it.
Lolas, thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure, Harry. Thanks.
It's been well worth waiting for.
All right.
Let's do it again.
On the issue of accountability, by the way, the Defense Contract Agency's chief in Washington, William Reed, says unsupported and questionable costs in Iraq reconstruction contracting total more than $10 billion. And he says of Pentagon contracting practices, Iraq being the tip of the iceberg, he says, quote, there's no accountability. Organizations charged with overseeing contracts are not held accountable. Contractors are not held accountable. It's the grown-ups in charge, ladies and gentlemen. That will do it for this week's edition of the show. I got to go out and get cold and throw some beads. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations. And by the way, a lot of people sorry this week, including Ed Rendell and JetBlue and Daryl Waltrip and Barack Obama. But Brian Williams appropriated the Apologies of the Week segment on NBC Nightly News this week, so I'm going to give it to him for the week. But I do owe an apology to everybody for a couple weeks ago putting Clemson in North Carolina when it's in South Carolina. So that's my apology of the week. Anyway, the program returns next week. And it would be just like you catching some bees. If you agree to join with at the end. With me then, would you? Alrighty, thank you very much. Uh-huh. The email address for this broadcast is lemail, L-E-M-A-I-L, at interworld.net. The show internet services by Steve McAtip at Le Show Chapeau to the San Diego and Pittsburgh desks, as well as to Bob Dunn, Lolas Eli, Jeffrey at AudioWorks, and of course, always to Pam Halstead for helping to make today's program possible. The show playlist available at harryshearer.com. Lolas Eli's columns appear in the New Orleans Times-Picayune, available on the internet at NOLA.com. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless. Happy Mardi Gras, everybody.